Hi, you guys. My name is Dudney, and welcome to another episode of Aggressive Negress. Yay! Where we'll be transgressing on today's taboo topics involving empowerment, gender, race, relationships, and a whole lot more, all through the lens of pop culture. If you've ever been to a house party, people sometimes congregate in the kitchen to chat, so grab your solo cup and let's talk. Woo! Summer, huh? Or something that is sort of supposed to be like summer, but actually felt like monsoon season followed by a heat wave. At least that's how, you know, it's been here in NYC. It's kind of ridiculous, but hey, climate change, am I right? But now, real quick, I want to shout out my homegirl, Shari Griffith, CEO of Soaps Atlanta, for being my guest on the previous episode. She is cooking up some really exciting things, so y'all look out for new products that'll be coming down the pike. I also want to let my listeners know that I heard you. And moving forward, I'll be making it a point to feature cool and interesting guests in some of these episodes. Oh, and some of y'all said y'all tired of hearing about R. Kelly too. Well, tough luck, because I pulled up a seat right in the front row to watch that nigga go down. I'm not getting up unless it's to use the bathroom or, you know, visit the concession stand. Now, do you want me to get you some nachos? You want some popcorn or what? Because we ain't moving. We're not moving. But in today's episode, I'm going to piggyback off the conversation that I had with Shari about me paying off my student loans and pivot towards how I actually got here to begin with. It wasn't an easy journey, and if at least one listener can take something from it, then it'll be worth taking a deep dive. I also recently finished a book by professor and cultural commentator Brittany Cooper called Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Funny enough, I had a friend ask on Facebook recently if any women in her friend group were uncomfortable being referred to as feminists. People went ham in the comments for the exact reasons Dr. Cooper expanded on in her book, some of which I'd like to talk to y'all about today. I'd also like to get into Ava DuVernay's new miniseries on Netflix, When They See Us, kind of expand on that a little bit. I'm sure most of y'all have seen or at least heard of the series. And lastly, Charlamagne the God, whom some of you may know as co-host of Power 105's The Breakfast Club morning radio show, recently got together with his friend, comedian Lil Duval, who himself recorded last year's hit Smile Bitch, which y'all might remember. It was the summer smash, a summer anthem. I'm living my best life. I ain't going back and forth with you niggas. I'm living my best life, you know? Anywho, those two got together to record a song called Black Men Don't Cheat, which they released last week. A song that I find utterly fucking ridiculous. And I'm happy to tell you why. Signed a black woman, period. No T at the end. But definitely period. But first, it's story time. Story time. Still working on that intro. My summer officially started on May 19. Why? That's when my vacation started. That's why. Fuck Mother Nature's timeline. I made my own. You feel me? A few of my friends and I booked a Royal Caribbean cruise, leaving out of Fort Lauderdale and traveling to Labadee, Haiti, Falmouth, Jamaica, and Cozumel, Mexico. It was 8 days of pure bliss, sand, drinks, and overall fun in the sun. In theory, in practice, I spent probably just as many nights passed out early in the room as I spent on the top deck smoking weed with niggas at 3 a.m. after the club let out. It's fucking weird. I don't know if y'all ever been on cruises or specifically, Royal Caribbean cruises, but I will say I was highly upset once I learned that the ship didn't have any water slides on board. It's ridiculous. This is only the second cruise I'd ever been on, and damn it, I was looking forward to the damn water slides. So, other than that, we all had bought the drink packages, which were so clutch. They cost a little bit up front, I'm not gonna lie to you, but the way, my vacation was set up, I pretty much recouped all those costs before like noon on each day. I think we realized by day three that our like deluxe beverage package or whatever entitled us to like fresh squeezed juice at breakfast. You know what I'm saying? And not like that Minute Maid from concentrate shit that they had out for everybody else. You know, it was like a little small win once we figured that out. Another small win was like about day five when my dumbass realized that the package also entitled me to top shelf liquor. Trust me, I beat myself enough just on the strength of discovering this on day five. You know what I'm saying? But from then on, it was just let me get that Johnnie Walker double black, or that green label when I saw it. Can I get that on the rocks? Thank you very much. That was the rest of the cruise. I wasn't even fucking around. Top shelf only. I had the best time in Haiti, but honestly didn't really get a chance to soak it all in. As a Haitian American, I had only been to Haiti once as a toddler, so I don't really remember much. The upside is that Labadee is Royal Caribbean's private section on the north coast of the island, so it wasn't like real Haiti anyway. So that's still a trip I plan to take, and will do so pretty soon. One of our tour guides ended up being a woman from the same hometown as my parents, which honestly was all the connection I needed at the moment. So I was good. I was straight. We also jet skied around the coast of the island, which was absolutely breathtaking and 100% exhilarating. I screamed like that pig in the old Geico commercial. Wee, just squealing in delight the entire time. And so much so that it took me a hot minute to realize that my friends who were right behind me had been thrown off their jet ski. They lived or whatever, so don't worry. But that was pretty much an ongoing source of laughs for the remainder of the trip. Jamaica was cool too. We did a river tubing excursion with, a few mild rapids thrown in the mix, nothing too major. Except that one of my friends screamed at the top of her lungs each and every time we hit a mild rapid, like as if we were going like class four whitewater rafting or some shit. Like some little ass bump and it's like death. Again, another source of laughs for the entire rest of the trip. Oh, and I also got the whole fucking boat to start chanting, "We are leaving." You know what I'm saying? Like I just started it up like we was at a basketball game. "We are leaving. We are leaving." Because one, I'm a lovable asshole. Just keep that in mind. Two, so we kind of just sitting there in the port, when we should have been pulled out. Literally everyone is out on their balconies just kind of enjoying the view. We're still in Jamaica, we're still in the port, we're supposed to have been gone, but we're still there. And my friends and I are on our porch too. All of a sudden you see like one of the excursion buses speeding down, coming down into the port area. They were late. Like everyone else had come back from their excursion. These niggas was late. So the people, they getting off the bus and they taking they sweet ass time walking back to the boat. I mean, I think I saw somebody stop off at a gift shop. Like niggas was still looking for shit to buy. Like they taking their time. Like niggas ain't been waiting on them. I ain't like that shit. So I started to chant, whatever. I started to chant. My friends picked it up. You know, before I knew what was happening, the entire balcony side of the boat picked up the chant too. So we out there, we leaving. You know what I'm saying? You know, best believe they picked their feet up and they started running. Come on, like, let's go, chop chop. Cozumel was dope too. Hot as fuck. Like, Haiti was blazing hot at 9 a.m. Early, hot. Jamaica, just as hot. Our river god, matter of fact, he invited us. He was like, yo, you know, towards the end of the tubing, he was like, hey, if y'all want to go ahead and dive in, you know, to cool off. I didn't even let him finish, you know, his sentence. I was in the water. I was like, it was just such a relief from the sun beating down on us, right? But Cozumel was unbearably hot. They had the type of heat, it just crept in through your nose and got inside of your brain and give you the headaches where you literally can't move, you can't do anything. Yo, if we hadn't gotten the cabana, I promise you, we would have stroked out right there on the beach. The only thing that helped us was getting in the water. Literally, even the shade in the cabana wasn't enough. That was literally it. For a while, we all looked like beach dolphins. We just laid in the shallow part of the beach, you know, letting the waves crash over us. It was that. That's all we needed. And the boat itself, the boat was cool too, you know, outside of having, you know, no damn water slides. But the food was really, really, really good. All of it was just bomb.com. The service was above and beyond. I even went to the gym and ran on the, you know, outside track, which had some sick ass views. I tried my hand at the rock climbing wall too, which was really fun, really challenging at the same time. I didn't try the surfing simulator because I wasn't interested in busting my ass, but it looked like the people who did bust their ass had a fun time doing it, so good for them. I got and one on the basketball court by some little kids. So again, I can bust my ass without any additional help. Thank you very much. But most of the time, you know, we just kind of spent it out by the pool, laid out, drinking, you know, meeting people, talking to people. I'd definitely do it again, you know, as long as the ports of call were of interest. Otherwise, I think I'd much rather, you know, just stay at a resort because, you know, one thing that's for certain, you can't get seasick on land. So yeah, there's that. In any event, I posted some pictures and videos from the trip on my social media pages. So y'all go ahead and check them out. After the jump, I'll switch gears into the science behind getting Sally Mae the fuck off my back. My hope again is that something I did might be able to help you as well. So stay tuned. So as I mentioned earlier, in the last episode, we touched on the fact that I had recently paid off my student loans. I made my last payment to Sally Mae, or as they are now known, Navient, in March 2019. March 11th at 2:48 p.m., to be exact. No, kidding. But last payment was definitely this past March, and I used a portion of my income tax money to finally get it off my books. A practice that I'd done almost every year for the last couple of years. Before I get into details though, I must say it absolutely does help to have solid and consistent income coming in. I think where young adults run into a lot of trouble and fast is when they enter a job market with few decent prospects. You're already behind the eight ball with all this debt that you've accumulated. You either can't find a job or can't find one with starting wages that will allow you to put a roof over your head, food in your stomach, you know what I'm saying? Enough money to pay for all your bills, you know, basic shit, nothing too crazy. But, you know, it's a struggle. And it's a damn shame, really. I graduated college in May 2007 with over $80,000 in student loans. I had friends who finished undergrad with way more, some approaching the $100,000 benchmark, some surpassing it. And to top it all off, that was right around when the recession hit here in the US, you know, making a perfect shit show of a storm for my fellow college grads and I. You know, I toiled around for a bit, you know, with a couple jobs here and there before I landed a decent paying sales job by the end of that year. Now, here's where I'd love to tell y'all that I did the responsible thing and made paying back my student loans a top priority, you know, but I'd be lying through my teeth. I definitely put them shits in deferment for as long as I could so I didn't have to pay them. Once I exhausted that option, I faithfully paid the minimum amounts and not a penny more. I really thought, you know, I thought I was doing something. I thought I had hit a pause, you know, hit that pause button on Sally Mae. But in actuality, that bitch was accruing interest on the principal amount the entire time. I'll pause here again and say very bluntly, do not do this. Don't do this. That's not the way to go. There are very solid reasons to defer paying student loans, you know, whether it be a hardship on your part or unemployment. And these options can be available to you should you need them. If you don't need them, then you're better off paying something, even the minimum payment amount. And if you do get on deferment, if possible, continue to make payments towards the interest. Even if you just covering the interest, make those payments. Because as most of you know, when it comes to debt, that compound interest becomes your worst enemy. You end up paying interest on top of the interest, on top of that interest, and so on. So in any event, it really wasn't until around 2013 or 2014 or so, I'm guesstimating, but around there, that's when I got serious about paying down my debt. It was at that time when I met up with an old college friend of mine for drinks and to catch up. She was younger than me. She had graduated with a finance degree the year after I did. So anyway, we met up for drinks in Midtown, you know, and talked about, among other things, student loans. This conversation was the turning point for me because she proceeded to tell me, "Dudney, I just made my last payment to Sally Mae and I'm so happy." Naturally, I replied, "Bitch, how?" Like, what the fuck? Sure, let me know. And so she explained that she'd been following this author and radio show host by the name of Dave Ramsey and recommended that I read his book, The Total Money Makeover, A Proven Plan for Financial Fitness. In it, he outlines the debt snowball method of paying down debts from smallest to biggest. He also held several seminars in the city, which she said she also attended. I'll pause here once again and say I typically look at most of these things through cynical, you know, New Yorker eyes. Like, okay, I buy your book, I pay you hundreds more to attend your little workshops and your little seminars. Then I pay on top of that for the study guide and the materials and the online classes. It never ends. Fuck out of here, right? I never liked Susie Orman for this very reason. And she was hot. She was hot around this time. And she was honestly out there dropping gems. But I just felt like I never could trust her. And I was, you know, low-key ready to put Dave in the same boat until my friend told me that she was like, "Yo, I had committed to his program only 2 years prior." So I'm like, "Oh, word? 2 years, that's nothing. Hold on, how much debt did you start with?" Right? I was hooked as soon as she said, "Listen, I got two pieces of paper when I finished school. One was my diploma and the other one was a bill for just over $100,000. So I'm like, "Oh, you know what I mean?" I'm like turning it over and over in my head, like, So one, this was someone I personally knew and trusted. Two, she graduated a year after I did. Three, she graduated with more debt than I had. Four, this man's program helped her pay it off in full in just 2 years. I should note that she owned a condo in Connecticut, so she had a home mortgage, as did I. But more important than that, she had solid and consistent income. As I mentioned earlier, the absence of this makes it more difficult to chip away at debt. It doesn't make it impossible, but it definitely makes it harder, especially living here in New York City. I'm a realist, okay, so I can 100% admit this. Still, you know, I personally had been somewhat blessed professionally, and I kind of suspected my income didn't match hers, like, at all. But I was still doing well. And I thought if she did it in 2 years, I could probably do it in three, maybe four, if I stumbled a bit. The next few things out her mouth threw me for a whole ass loop. She goes to me, oh, and I also work part-time at the Gap. My jaw dropped. At the time, I couldn't imagine her working retail 15, 20 hours a week on top of a full-time job in finance. She's like, yeah, you know, I work there whenever I can, mostly weekends, but some nights too. She's like, the check from that job goes directly to my student loans, no exceptions. And on top of that, I live well below my means. You know what I mean? I eat ramen noodles damn near every night. We even started laughing a little bit, reminiscing about all the struggle meals that we had to put up with in our college days. You know, cheese sandwiches were my specialty. Ask anybody who lived in my dorms or were roommates of mine, that was my jam. And still, I couldn't quite understand why a person would live this way on purpose when they didn't have to. So she, you know, explaining it, she cut down on all her expenses, cable, cell phone, food, eating out, travel, you name it. And if there was something that she could pare down, she could pare down or do without it, she did that. And the exact dollar amount that she saved went towards her student loans. This is how I knew for sure I was looking at a 3-4 year time frame, because I wasn't eating no goddamn ramen. That's not me. But that's how committed she was. And that's ultimately what a plan like this needs, commitment. There's no magic way to do it. Bankruptcy doesn't solve your problems. It literally requires you to buckle down and get laser focused. And, you know, that's what I did, y'all. You know, she let me borrow her copy of the book, the Dave Ramsey book. I eventually bought my own, you know, so I could kind of, it struck me as, you know, it's definitely one of those books you want to own, scribble down notes in, and so on. I found his debt snowball worksheets online for free and printed them out as needed just to sort of help me formulate a plan to tackle my student loans. For example, you could approach the debt from the smallest to the biggest amounts. But I chose to start with the loans that had the highest interest rates. I figured, you know, I had already been given away free money in the form of interest and wanted to knock those out first. I included all my other revolving accounts, like credit card debts, but prioritized the student loans as that was what I wanted to, you know, focus on. That was the main point. It was also a psychological win to see loan, you know, after student loan being paid off. Looking back, the smart thing to do, which I started doing towards the end, would have been to unequivocally stick to the high interest rate debt plan. The highest interest rate on my student loans didn't creep too far past 8%, but the interest rates on my credit cards were anywhere from 12 to 20%. So for those who don't claim math to be their strong suit, that means that as I had my head down trying to get rid of Sallie Mae debt first, I was actually losing even more money in the form of interest to my credit cards. Basically, I was pushing water uphill with a rake. But that being said, Mr. Ramsey explains in his book that in order to really commit to paying down debt, you have to be locked in psychologically. You have to be locked in mentally. And if I kept a dartboard with Sallie Mae's face on it for motivation, then that's just what the fuck I needed to do. So if paying off the smaller amounts regardless of interest rates, is what you need to do, because psychologically it feels like you're making progress when those smaller debts fall off, then do that too. The second suggestion in Mr. Ramsey's book was to empty your entire bank account except for $1,000. And that $1,000 would be kept for emergencies only. And allocate all the other funds, the rest of the funds, to the debt on the top of your list to jumpstart the snowball process. Only having $1,000 to my name gave me instant anxiety. It is giving me anxiety right now. So I upped it to a workable $3,000. And as instructed, I made the payment to Sallie Mae with the rest to kick things off. It's a commitment. It's a commitment. The third part of the plan was to work the envelope system alongside the debt snowball method. This is basically budgeting on steroids. It involves taking stock on the actual dollar amount that you spend monthly on things other than the debt that you're working on, after you found ways to pare down your expenses, of course. For example, let's say you're down to $75 a month on groceries, $100 on gas, $50 on restaurants, $100 on beauty and grooming, right? That's your monthly budget. What you do is you keep the cash in marked envelopes for each of these categories. Unlike mindlessly swiping a credit or a debit card, which can lead to overspending without you even realizing it, the envelope method forces you to stick to the budget that you set by working basically through a cash-based system. Once you've cleaned the envelope out, you have no more funds for that particular category until the following month. So you basically have to think about, okay, this is how much money I have left. How am I gonna work in, you know, each of these categories, the groceries that I need to shop for, to eat for the month? You gotta work it out with the money that you've given yourself. So like I said, budgeting on steroids. but it was a really cool way to be intentional about how much I was spending and on what. Last but not least, I needed to secure part-time work. I had a friend who got me started as a seasonal employee at the Nine West Shoe Store in Jersey Gardens Mall. I was able to stay on past the Christmas season that year and ultimately spent a little over 2 years there, mostly working 10, 12 hour days on Saturdays and Sundays while working my full-time job Monday to Friday. Those were the toughest 2 years of my life. I'm not even gonna lie to you. As you can imagine, I had to sacrifice quite a lot. My body took a toll. My social life took a nosedive. I do still have a closet full of Nine West shoes, though, so that was a plus. But I literally worked at Nine West until I couldn't anymore, you know, which was around the time when my mom got sicker, you know, because setbacks, those are almost guaranteed to happen. Despite that, I did my best to continue to follow the principles in the Total Money Makeover book. Along the way, I opened credit cards that had the longest 0% introductory interest rates on balance transfers that I could find. You know, my credit score is pretty good, and eventually I was able to attract 0% transfer fees in addition to the 0% intro rates. So in other words, it cost me nothing to do the transfer. Typical fees are anywhere from 3 to 5% of the amount being transferred, right? So taking the debt from one credit card, adding it onto another credit card, not paying anything on top of that, and then extending the life of a 0% interest rate on that same amount. I mean, it literally cost me nothing to keep the debt on their books from month to month until the introductory period was over, which was typically 15, 21 months later. I also refinanced the higher rate interest loans, which shaved off a little over 2% in interest. You can totally shop around, you know, see who'll give you the most competitive rates. I personally use a company called SoFi to do this. And then there's the business of my income tax money. First off, I'm no fool. I know this is my own goddamn money. I'm just getting it back at the end of the year. It's not an annual gift from the government. And I personally always keep my own withholdings on my W-4 at a 1 or 2 to minimize how much the government takes out of my check. So to that end, I always approach my refund in a pragmatic way. You know, I tuck a third of it away for savings, usually, you know, for whatever vacation I'm taking that year. That's typically my reward to myself. The rest went towards the debt. I tried to save smarter as well. I made it a habit to seek out high yield interest rate checking accounts. Back in its heyday, you could easily find banks where you earned 5 to 6% on your money. The catch was usually something like you had to opt in for electronic statements, you needed to make at least one direct deposit every month, or swipe the debit card anywhere from 10 to 15 times a month. But that was doable. Self-checkout became my best friend because I'd ring up small things like packs of gum as separate transactions. In this same time period, I also began working with a financial advisor to maximize my retirement savings. I'm talking 401k, Roth IRA, mutual funds, so on. My mom's situation nudged me in this direction simply because as she got sicker and she couldn't work anymore, we realized that she had nothing set up for her retirement years. Thankfully, she worked for the city of New York, so she had a small pension, but it was nowhere near what she would need to, you know, kind of keep her same standard of living once she retired, once she was no longer working. So, you know, I've been dragging my feet on that right up until that realization set in. I didn't want that to be me because I knew I'd be shit out of luck. I'm trying to do better even now at investing into the stock market, investing money there. And I'm always looking for opportunities to just overall build wealth. These days, there's so much information online for free that you can access if you need tips or a plan, you know, something to get you started on knocking down your debt. There are just as many paid resources as well, which if you recall from my New York cynicism earlier, I don't think are all that necessary. But if you need a harder kick in the pants, maybe someone, you know, to appear out of thin air, yoke your ass up when you're about to order an $8 drink at Starbucks, perhaps the fact that you went out and spent money on a program might be the motivation that you need. Whatever. It's all mental. So what you need to get you going, whatever it is that you need to do, I'd just be happy to know that you're doing it. Of course, I happen to swear by Dave Ramsey. Even if you don't get to attend his seminars, I'm cool with that. Like I said, I didn't. But just kind of check him out as well. Make sure he's on the list of resources. I touched on some of his suggestions today, but truthfully, I barely scratched the surface on what he delves into in the book. But if you're ready to receive the word, to receive the gospel, the Total Money Makeover book is an excellent place to start. All right, y'all, be right back after this break. While we're on the subject of books, one of my most recent reads was Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower, by Brittany Cooper. Writer for Cosmopolitan, Joy Reid, calls it a dissertation on Black women's pain and possibility, which is a great way to sum up this book in the fewest words. It's sort of a memoir that combines cultural criticism and personal reflections to explore how she and the Black women she's encountered use rage, joy, and everything in between to carve their own unique spaces in this world. I won't dissect the whole book. I'll leave that for y'all to decide to pick up a copy or not. But what I did want to talk about was a few of the points Dr. Cooper brought up that really stuck out to me. First of which, she presents the idea that you can't quite be a feminist unless you love women and love being a friend to women. it got me thinking that such a stance really goes against the grain of the patriarchy. In other words, to love women does not mean you love men any less. Some of you may have come across similar opinions when someone wants to all lives matter your Black Lives Matter post on social media. Just because the movement is about Black lives doesn't mean you're shitting on anyone else. You know what I'm saying? But essentially the essence of it, in my opinion, is that I want the best for any woman. And in particular, I'm all the way here for the successes of any woman of color. I see this play out in my personal friendships with other women. I love all my friends fiercely and without shame. I'll be quick to comment a yes, bitch, yes, under any post my friends, you know, make to shine light on their achievements. But as a bisexual woman, I was particularly intrigued when the author admitted that, you know, sometimes her love for women crosses into the sexual realm. I immediately thought of, you know, some of the first bonds that I made with other girls through basketball. As any woman who grew up playing team sports will tell you, your fellow teammates grow to be like your sisters. You all go through trials and tribulations together, especially during the teen, preteen era when the foundation is set for some of the deepest first loves a girl will ever have. I should note here that I mean to describe these as platonic relationships. But I can see Dr. Cooper's point in saying that Black female friendships are inherently queer. So she states that we kind of make an intentional commitment to love each other and love on each other, show up for each other in the fullness of our Blackness in a system that kind of normalizes white supremacy and anti-Blackness. Think of the last time as a Black woman you told another Black woman, you know, okay, shoulders, you know, or, ooh, that dress got your titties looking right. You know what I mean? The heteronorm dictates that care and that attention should come from whoever you fucking. Black women are always on the ready to provide these affirmations, especially when we know that the whole world won't see it the same way that we do. You know what I'm saying? You know, because yes, bitch, the girls were sitting just right in this dress. Thank you for noticing. and allowing ourselves to do that, given these state of affairs, she argues, is queer. That being said, I can see why, you know, the feminist label often gets grouped together with lesbian. Because the thinking is along the lines of, one, you know, how can you be straight and show this much love for women? By the way, that is your indentured servitude to the patriarchal society showing. So you might want to tuck that in. And two, gay women are just another marginalized group fighting for a seat at the table. As I said earlier, a friend had posted on Facebook if she knew any women who kind of shied away from being labeled a feminist. And the comments were intriguing. Most were somewhere in the ballpark of no, because that's a movement reserved mostly for white women. Some even preferred the more general term of womanists, which was coined by writer and activist Alice Walker. While others simply said, you know, I'm just here for women of color only. That's it. You know what I'm saying? However, a lot of them were quick to point out that none of this meant that they were anti-man. They were simply pro-respect and pro-egalitarianism. That's simply it. The reason for women of color, I think, to see Black feminism or womanism as something entirely different, I think can be demonstrated in the fact that white women overwhelmingly supported Trump's bid for presidency, all but assuring his seat in the White House. And as a matter of fact, white women have consistently voted against their own self-interests. There are battles raging in courts all over the U.S. as we speak over a woman's right to have an abortion. To me, it begs the question, do white women want all women to be seen, recognized, and respected? Or do they simply want the power, as men have had for years, to control or dictate what other women can and cannot do? You know what I mean? So it just blows my mind, as Dr. Cooper points out, how white women choose to kind of uphold their whiteness before upholding anything that supports their womanhood. It's one of the reasons I always say I'm black first and a woman second. You know, perhaps a topic for another day, but similarly, black men are quick to uphold their manhood, you know, because patriarchy, before supporting the blackness in themselves and others. That's, I mean, I don't want to open a can of worms, but that's generally true. But, you know, my point being is that sometimes at the very core, all black women have are other black women. We all we got. And therein lies the crux of the book, A Black Woman's Eloquent Rage. The quote-unquote angry black woman trope works in part, well, because black women are angry. Dr. Cooper presents a well-articulated and thorough body of work that dissects how the intersection of patriarchy, racism, and sexism have combined to determine the boundaries of black women's lives in both concrete and not so concrete ways. I would argue that one need look no further than Tarana Burke, a black woman, an activist who in 2006 began using the phrase Me Too. She started that to raise awareness of sexual abuse and sexual assault. More than a decade later, Alyssa Milano, a white woman, an activist in her own right, uses Me Too in a hashtag. And the entire movement rapidly gained steam, both in the media and in popular culture. Why was that? Well, when white women holler, this country stands up, takes notice, with the same acuteness that my dog has when he notices a squirrel nearby. Just ask Emmett Till. So, you know, the author goes on to make a point that probably goes down as one of my favorites in the book. Young white women using black culture, using hip hop culture to appear grown or rebellious, then almost always discarding the culture when it no longer suits them. Miley Cyrus, anyone? either way, growing up playing sports for me let me know that it was okay to simply love other women, or stated differently, women deserve to be loved. In this light, Dr. Cooper came back with the oft used example of Beyonce, Miss Queen B herself. See, I guess B was always asked, you know, she identified as a feminist. And after years of avoiding being publicly, I guess, pigeonholed into a box, she finally accepted the title. She explained even further about how being in Destiny's Child taught her to love and appreciate female friendships in all of their forms. Growing up in the group, you know, they're chasing their dreams. And even after they reach success, Beyonce said she never wanted to put the relationships that she forged with the other girls in jeopardy. More than that, being in the group, you know, that took up all her time. It kept her out of trouble to the point where she didn't really have opportunities to get into the trouble that her youth typically will get into. From having the time to even potentially get attached to some jerk-ass boyfriends and grade-A fuckboys, right? So the collective of Beyonce, Kelly, and at the time LaToya and Latavia were once again 1,000% committed to the dream of making it in the music industry. I think back to my youth, where I and a lot of my other teammates were obsessed with basketball. The commitment was there, but for some of the girls, it wasn't quite there. You know what I mean? And those were the girls who started coming to practice less and less, started hanging out with the boys more and more, getting into all types of shenanigans that young girls go through. Did those girls love themselves less? My answer is it's possible. if they weren't committed to the game as much as Beyonce was committed to Destiny's Child, then what were they committed to? What were they throwing all that effervescent teenage energy into? Because it's energy and it's going somewhere, right? So where's it going? And speaking of youth, Dr. Cooper also addresses how sex is used to regulate young girls and women, in the sense of young girls and women should by no means be having sex if they wanted to be smart and successful. This is a narrative that I discuss amongst my girls all the time, particularly in the West Indian community. Young girls were told, you know, focus on your books, get good grades, graduate high school, go to college, get a degree or two or three or four, right? Get a good job, have a meaningful career. And at the same time, you weren't supposed to be thinking about sex. You weren't supposed to be thinking about boys. You were supposed to somehow date around and have fun, but then find your husband, get married, and start pushing out babies just so your mom can gush over her grandbabies before getting too old to chase toddlers around. The problem is that in checking all the boxes, or trying to, is definitely easier said than done. You know, in my opinion, it's just more common to find one or the other, or some never quite right combination of both. You can't have it all. You know what I mean? I don't want to say you can't have it all, but it's rare. It's super rare. I myself am an educated, successful Black woman approaching her mid-30s, one who's checked several of the mama I made it, you know, type boxes, with a dog who I treat like my child because he is. One who also hears, you know, interestingly enough, from the same mama who preached the education gospel. You know, I guess the dog is supposed to be my grandbaby. Or, you know, when are you going to settle down and get married and so on? I mean, can I get an amen if you can relate? I'm not the only one. I don't even have to ask. I'm not the only one. Right? So at the end of the day, I think Eloquent Rage is a must read. I feel like Brittany Cooper covers everything that I've ever thought or wanted to say as it pertains to Black women and what our version of feminism looks like. It's powerful. You know, it's heartbreaking. It's hilarious. All the while kind of retaining a sense of accessibility and relatability to the weighty subject matter. And she analyzes it in such an articulate and highly academic way. It just, you know, my brain just automatically gravitates towards it. So yeah, definitely a must read. I would, you know, I definitely recommend y'all check that out. By now, I'm sure most of us have heard about Ava DuVernay's When They See Us television miniseries. The critically acclaimed project premiered on Netflix a few weeks ago, and it already shattered some records for most watched on the platform. The limited series dives into the story of the Central Park Five, or the Exonerated Five, as they are now known as these days. For those that aren't familiar, there were a series of attacks in Manhattan Central Park in April 1989. That were allegedly committed by a group of 30-some-odd teenagers. The most publicized of these was the rape and assault of a woman who was jogging in the park. These five boys were ultimately tried and convicted for the crime in 1990, convictions that were later vacated after the real perpetrator was identified in 2002 by, among other things, DNA evidence. By that time, all the men had already served their sentences, so they filed a suit against New York City in 2003 for wrongful conviction and were awarded a settlement in 2014. They went ahead and filed a suit against the state of New York and received a settlement from them as well. Y'all's commander-in-chief, Donald Trump, also famously made headlines in May of 1989 for taking out full-page ads in all four of the city's major newspapers at the time, calling for the return of the death penalty. Trump's ads were quoted in part as saying, quote, "I want to hate these muggers and murderers. They should be forced to suffer. I want to hate these murderers, and I always will. How can our great society tolerate the continued brutalization of its citizens by crazed misfits?" End quote. Whew. Well, fast forward to When They See Us, a film by award-winning Ava DuVernay, a dynamic storyteller in her own right. I particularly enjoyed her documentary on Netflix, 13th. Enjoyed her turn as director of the movie Selma, and several more bodies of her work. I say that to say this. I know sis went in on When They See Us. So much so that it has a name, dubbed the Ava Effect. All right, pop culture, the media, and every outlet imaginable have been praising the series for its raw and gritty take, holding back no punches. None at all, as the Exonerated Five get to tell their story in their own words to the world. So you can understand when I say that no, I have not seen When They See Us, and I do not plan to watch it anytime soon. I would like to watch it. I really would. But I'm not ready. I'm not even sure if or when I will be. Not when I could turn on the news or flip through social media on any given day in the year of our Lord 2019 and find footage of brown and black people being manhandled and mistreated by law enforcement. There's no way. There's the video of Phoenix police officers pointing guns and yelling profane commands at a black family with their young children. That was this past month. Or how about the woman in LA who became emotionally distraught while filming a young unarmed black man on his knees with his hands up in surrender, only because she genuinely feared that the police officers would kill him instead? And her fears weren't unfounded. As her video went on, it showed them training their weapons, some of them military style weapons, on the young man, on her at times. Showing what the woman filming the whole situation, what she believed to be excessive force. And guys, I can go on. Y'all may have heard about the Arkansas police officer who asked a black man he had just pulled over to shut off his car. And the young man who had started filming the encounter slowly reaches to cut the ignition. And as he does so, the officer yells, "Gun! He's got a gun!" He was simply reaching to cut the car off as he had been instructed to do. And there was another brother in Boulder, Colorado, picking up trash outside of his dorm for his work study job. And he got approached by a police officer. He continued to be detained as the officer called for backup, even after he showed him his proper identification. And you better believe the backup officer showed up, guns blazing, ready for war. They was ready. You know, police officers shoot and kill another young brother in an Alabama mall. They tell another brother in Charlotte, North Carolina, to drop his weapon, but shoot and kill him as he begins to comply. I don't get how, you know, stories like this and more from decades and decades prior don't help to illustrate the painstaking steps people of color feel they have to take in order to survive. To just survive run-ins with law enforcement. I can turn my phone on right now and scroll by any version of these stories from just this week. So yeah, I applaud all the people who have tuned in, you know, to watch DuVernay's When They See Us. I want even more people to do so. I hope if you're listening right now and haven't seen it, that you head to the Netflix account that you share with your bestie, your auntie, your cousin, and your grandma and them, and start watching. But this aggressive Negress is gonna have to take a knee on that. Simple and plain. Simple and plain. We'll be right back after this. Black men don't cheat. Yeah. Except for, you know, when they do. I think that's is that how the song goes or something? I don't even. So earlier this month, radio host Charlamagne Tha God and comedian Lil Duval released a new song called Black Men Don't Cheat. It immediately set social media and all the internets ablaze. On the track, Duval and Charlamagne sing the praises of black men for their faithfulness, shooting down typical accusations that they face when suspected of cheating on their significant others, which is all well and good. But listen, y'all can claim a day to rep yourselves. Y'all can trend on Twitter if you want to. Have y'all wives and women stand for the kings in their lives. I applaud all of that. I do. But you ain't fooling a real one like me. You not fooling a real one like rapper Trina. Or a real one like the multi-talented Amanda Seales. For her part, Amanda shared a post recently that also praised the movement. But she reminded us that not cheating on your partner is a basic requisite for being in a relationship. And she went on to suggest several other tenets that required much more work and much more self-awareness than to simply not cheat. Fair enough. I got newfound respect for Trina after I caught her on The Breakfast Club recently. She was on there promoting her new album. And it just so happened that Charlamagne wasn't there that day, which was unfortunate. But I dug the interview because she dug deeper and asked the right questions. You know, she asked for further clarification. You know, like, are you telling black men not to cheat, claiming that they don't cheat? Are you just kind of making fun of the ones who got caught cheating? You know what I mean? Like, let me know. Let me explain it a little bit. Trina even dug into Charlamagne's marriage a little bit. She discovered that in his 20-plus year relationship, he'd only really been faithful for the last 3 or 4 years. So there was a transition. There was a growth that happened there, obviously. She also challenged every brother to count on one hand 5 other brothers that they knew who also didn't cheat. You know what I mean? Just to sort of say, who do you know? Who do you know? Who do you know? Hold your brothers accountable if that's the case. Which I think, again, is fair. Was she knocking the movement? I didn't think so. I think she was merely questioning the validity of it. Are black men hiding behind the hashtag or holding it up instead? To support the song, Charlamagne himself is always claiming, yo, I didn't say black boys, I said black men, you know, to which I would reply, okay, then like one of my favorite 90s R&B groups, when exactly, sir, tell me when exactly does the transition happen from boys to men? And how does my relationship with said boy or man correlate? Do I jump in when he's still a boy and wait on it? Or do I gamble and wait until he's shifted into being a man? What is a man, really? Is that an age, sir? Is that a state of mind? You know, will this man that you speak of be 5'3" and therefore of no use to me? Sorry, boo. Will this man present as a man when in all actuality he hasn't dealt with any of his triggers, any of his demons that increase the chances of him being a full partner? Damn it, I have questions. My aggressive Negresses out there have questions. Hell, we should all have questions. Why follow anything blindly, regardless of who says it? Not I. My brain don't work that way. Trina's brain don't work that way. Amanda's brain don't work that way. Hopefully your brain doesn't work that way either. But, you know, until then, I'll keep up with my usual niggas ain't shit and keep it moving. I mean, I'm rooting for y'all. I am. I really am. You know? Three cheers for the black men who don't cheat. All three of y'all. Y'all for listening and putting up with me in this crazy kooky schedule. I swear I may not ever make a cent, but that's okay because I do this for you guys. I'm doing it for me, of course, but with y'all in mind, you know, so it's like y'all are a part of it too. Yes, that includes you, Kendra Griffin. Love you, sis. As always, it is I, your host, Dudney. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at I Am Dudney. This podcast's social media pages are @_negress on Twitter and @aggressivenegress on IG. If you liked today's episode, please share it, subscribe to it, all of that. And of course, tell a friend to tell a friend to do the same. You can now listen to Aggressive Negress on iHeartRadio or wherever you get your podcasts. Again, we may not be that big yet, but this podcast is something that's definitely beyond me, and I am truly, truly, truly humbled by that. Red Solo Cup cheers, and thanks again for coming to my kitchen talk. Bye.